things about Tate Mills in Two Dimensions. And I will be Euclidean, in Euclidean signature, so no real distinction to be space. Nothing I say today is going to be original. I'm just going to try to summarize some of the key results that are important for Tate Mills, and I'll try to emphasize some of the results that will hopefully be useful preparation for thinking about higher dimensional field theories a little bit later on this week or next week. And we'll hopefully set up some concepts for things some of your other TAs will talk about later on. So, like I said, I'm not going to say anything original at all. There's a ton of literature even on this very simple field theory. So, most of what I said will be following kind of a canonical review for this subject, a very, very extensive review covering everything I'm going to talk about and more by Cordes, Moore, and Ron. And I'll try to reference other things as I go along. But essentially, this is kind of the key reference to all of the Salish literature. Okay, so, of course, we'll start with the usual thing, action, specializing in two dimensions. So here's the basic action principle we'll be working with, and this is taken as given for the ends. So, what are the basic ingredients? Well, at least locally, we'll identify F, our usual gauge field strength, as some kind of two-form on the two-dimensional Riemann surface on which the theory lives, valued in G. And today, I'll be focusing on gauge groups, either UN or SUN, mostly UN, and their generalized results to other things like orthogonal groups and symplectic groups that I won't talk about. And locally, as always, F is the curvature form of our connection A on some principle G bundle PF. I'll have this subscript N sometimes just to denote that we're indexing our gauge group by N to PN principle G bundle. Okay, so that's the standard action. I have some gauge coupling out front. But the nice thing about Yang-Mills in two dimensions is that it's actually far simpler than it initially appears, and is indeed much simpler than its higher dimensional analogs. And the basic reason for that is because we can consider star F. In other words, essentially by point grade, we just dualize our curvature form to some adjoint valued scalar F. G.
Sorry, is F in G sub G?
Sorry?
We have connections on P. Is it transforming to adjoint sub G?
Oh, yeah, sorry. F takes values in the adjoint bundle of P. Yeah. That was the question?
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. So we can rewrite the curvature as this scalar times mu, where mu I've defined to be an area form on the Riemann surface. Today I'll focus on oriented Riemann surfaces, but everything I say can be generalized with a little bit more care. If you wanted to work on, think about orientable and oriented Riemann surfaces, and if you wanted to think about non-orientable things, rather than treating mu as a two-form, you can treat it as a density, and rather than F just being an adjoint-valued scalar, you can view it as a section of an orientation bundle, which is just a representation of the bundle. But I'm not going to do any of that fancy stuff today. And with this identification, the action can just be rewritten as trace F squared times the area form. And of course, both of these actions they're equivalent, but as always, the Yang-Mills action is invariant under gauge transformations. But moreover, when I write it in this way, we see that in two dimensions, actually, the invariance through but the action is much larger. And in fact, if we just act on this Lagrangian, or on this action, by orientation preserving diffeomorphisms of my surface, 2D angles theory is invariant. Not just usual. So you might expect that because there's this huge symmetry group that the theory enjoys, that Daniel's theory in two dimensions is actually quite a bit simpler than its higher dimensional counterparts. Or if you like the sort of the gauge group, if I think of these transformations as also being sort of part of an enhanced gauge group, it's so huge that I can essentially gauge away most of the degrees of freedom in 2D angles. I'll be a little bit more precise later on. But the intuition is just that because the invariance group is so large, we don't really have that many degrees of freedom left over in this kind of low dimensionality.
Sorry, what was this?
Oh, orientation.
Orientation preserved.
Okay. So as I said, there's a huge amount to say about 2D angles, and I'll tour through most of it. But there's a lot of nice work, for instance, classically. You can just study the theory based on the Lagrangian. My work with Atiyah Bhatt. So for example, we can just look at the equations of motion of our action. Where dA is the covariant derivative with respect to the gauge connection A on our bundle at the end. And this equation of motion tells us that good solutions to the classical equation of motions are given by covariant and constant sections of ad pn.
It always like section as a D of something.
Sorry?
It always like the section as a curvature of something.
Can I always write such a section as a curvature?
So is that also supposed to go both ways? Or go both?
Well, so this is a purely geometric statement that someone other than me might know, but I think at least in this context it goes both ways. Unless I'm mistaken. Okay, so given some solution like this, so covariantly constant section X, then if you want to study such a solution, what happens is that having this non-trivial solution X reduces the structure group from mu n to some subgroup that stabilizes X, or a centralizer subgroup of X. And then the classical solution can instead be thought of, if you like, as a flat connection of some associated bundle with respect to the subgroup that centralizes X, twisted by some kind of constant curvature line bundle that's associated to the U1 subgroup of UN that preserves X. And the TN go through in great detail how to sort of build up these constants, these classical solutions of Yang-Mills on general Riemann surfaces. And in particular, because there's a way to sort of break these solutions down into flat connections, the essential data of the solutions is encoded in holonomies, which is one way to sort of see that 2D Yang-Mills theory is particularly simple, at least at the level of these classical solutions, because everything is kind of packaged into holonomies rather than local excitations. And again, I'll say something a little bit more details later on. But there's a beautiful story here that's related to something called a non-abelian localization, it's called non-abelian localization. I won't say more about it in the talk, but there's a very rich story in geometry already with that. And that was purely.
I say holonomies, what do you mean?
Holonomies is the gauge group on around.
So, but it's curvature, right? So I have like this time, which is.
Yeah, this is why I'm not going to talk about this perspective very much, but you can sum over 2D. I mean, you can rewrite the partition function of Yang-Mills purely in terms of instantons. So there's some sum over instantons with non trivial C1, and in sort of trade holonomy variables for instantons. view that I want. That's kind of what that perspective is useful for, but I'm not going to say. Okay, so. So there's a lot to say about the classical theory if we wish, but let's just start thinking about 2D NULs as a quantum theory, and in particular, we should identify the Hilbert space of our theory. And if there are many ways to sort of reach the answer to the Hilbert space, in particular, you can just go through a process of canonical quantization of this classical action. And you find that the Hilbert space is L2 class functions on the gauge group G. And more generally, if I have Yang-Mills theory in D dimensions, then the Hilbert space that the theory associates to C to some D minus 1 manifold Y I can write it as something like this, where my curly A is the space of connections of the principal bundle. And this G hat is the set of maps from Y to G, relying on the space of connections by local gauge transformations. And in two dimensions, the D minus 1 manifold Y is just a circle. And so the only sort of gauge invariant information that the connection has is the conjugacy class of the monotomy of the gauge connection. So this is just the space of conjugacy classes. Or in other words, the Hilbert space is the space of square normalizable class functions on G. And of course, there's a natural inner product on this space. Which, I don't know if I've written it down, but.
Can you say one more time where the Hilbert space came from? What did you geometrically quantize to get the Hilbert space?
Yeah, I mean, in fact, let me say a little bit more about where I got the Hilbert space. I think I prepared a little more. But one more thing I wanted to say about the space is that because I've landed on the space of class functions, then there's a natural sort of decomposition of the space of class functions in terms of a nice basis where the basis is just furnished by irreducible representations of the gauge group. So R will always denote Europe's gauge group. So,
wait, you mean like one? Like,
okay.
I'm diagonal, right? Maybe diagonal entries inside of R cross R, I think.
Because it will be a G invariant. I think they're complaining that this is not the G invariant.
Oh, yeah. There should upper top. You want an upper G on the.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. No, not that. That one already had it. The class function was already a variant. Far right.
Oh,
there.
You want?
Yeah. Because when you had written down without that, it's like the Hilbert space on an interval. Without the G, that's like the Hilbert space on an interval, right?
Okay. Let's see. Okay, so I could say more about canonical quantization, but I might actually skip that. Okay, so of course it's the Hilbert space, there should be some nice pairing on the space, and the natural one is to just integrate functions, conjugate,
Where the measure is given by upper measure of G, unit normalized so that the volume of the gauge group has unit volume. So in particular, any wave function that I write down, I might have some wave function psi of the gauge connection. But in particular, because the Hilbert space is just the space of class functions, and there's a few ways to see the invariance of the wave functions with respect to the conjugation of the group, I can actually rewrite it as a functional only of the path ordered exponential of the gauge connection, where I'm viewing the theory, setting my theory again on a cylinder, where the circle is of length L. So studying that Hilbert space. So my integral here is just from 0 to L the length of the cylinder. And this is what I'm calling my variable u. And it's invariant under, this is a class function, psi is a class function, of course. And so in particular, if I think of my Hilbert space in the representation basis of Urex, then any wave function that I write, if I represent the state by the variable u, which is my Wilson line, then the wave function will just be the character of u in the representation R. So again, the non-trivial degrees of freedom in the theory are really the Wilson lines, the non-local operators. And they're sort of, and packaged this way, we see that the wave functions are already invariant under the conjugacy class. Question? Is that kind of clear? Yeah.
I'm sorry. Sorry, you said this already. So just to be clear, this is square normalizable functions.
Square normalizable class functions.
Sorry, the state space is square normalizable functions from the quotientid space of connections to square normalizable functions in the group.
The Hilbert space of Yang-Mills in any dimension is going to be these square normalizable functions on the space of all connections modded out by g hat, where g hat is the z minus one manifold into the gauge group.
Right.
And in this particular case, that reduces to the square normalizable class functions on G.
Sorry.
Because
that's
S1.
There's an equal sign between those two things.
Yeah.
I see. Sorry.
So we always want to think of Yang-Mills in the basis. Given by these Wilson loop variables that I'm denoting by u, and you can, starting with the action that I gave you, look at the Hamiltonian, which is of course equivalent to the Lagrangian, and you can write the Hamiltonian in terms of functional derivatives with respect to the gauge connection.
Sorry, can you have some notation? Take the blank in front of you. Over there, we define the wave function. So,
yeah.
Like, phi r of u is the.
Yeah, so I have some wave function. It's just a function of this Wilson loop u that I'm denoting by u.
Okay.
And I can represent a wave, and if I choose to represent. Some state in the Hilbert space in the Braquette notation, then I can decompose that state with respect to the basis of Urex, which is the natural basis of this Hilbert space, and the overlap of those states is then just going to be the character in the given representation, the character of U and R.
Sorry, what's the D minus one manifold Y? What is that? Sigma is the surface, and then Y is what?
Okay, so the statement up there is true for Yang-Mills in any dimension, the Hilbert space. And so I can ask what Hilbert space does d-dimensional Yang-Mills associate to a closed circuit, a closed D minus one manifold Y. And in two dimensions, by closed D minus one manifold Y is this form. So when I ask what Hilbert space of states is 2D angles associated with the circle, the answer is that space that L squared is. So I can rewrite, take my Lagrangian and write Hamiltonian instead, which puts things in a more quantum mechanical formulation. But the main point, and there's a few manipulations that I'll skip, but you can always ask me afterwards for the details, is that the Hamiltonian acting on a state in my particular representation basis, in particular on some basis vector, turns out to be given by up to a constant multiple, the quadratic Casimir of that representation. So the representation basis diagonalizes the Hamiltonian. It's a very short computation to show that. And for those of you that like classical electrodynamics, this way that I've written the Hamiltonian is just H equals E squared. But you might remember the energy stored in a gauge field is, in general, E squared plus B squared, electromagnetic field. But I'm in two dimensions, so I only have what's essentially E squared.
And lambda is E squared with a factor of L.
Yeah, and I've just defined this constant lambda as my gauge coupling times the rank of the gauge group, which physicists call the Itokh coupling. And it shows up in other places, but won't be important for my story today. Another thing to notice is that in 2D angles, in the form of the action that I've since erased, you always have E squared and the total area of the surface appearing in this combination together, E squared A. And so for the rest, and that turns out to always be true. So for the rest of the talk, I'm just going to set E squared to 1, and you can always restore it whenever you see an area of my surface appearing anywhere. But that's just for notation. Okay, so fundamental variables of 2D angles are these Wilson loop variables. And so the data in the theory should be given by correlation functions of as many Wilson loops as I like, encircling my surface. Okay? So what I'd like to do today is at least outline the solution to that problem of computing correlation functions and, in special case, the partition function of 2D angles, which can indeed be done exactly, which is kind of the nice thing about this theory. It's a bit of a baby quantum field theory where everything is solvable. And the way we do this, at least using a traditional style, is to do something that Davide mentioned actually in his lecture that works much better than you expect it to in two dimensions. So in particular, if I wanted to compute something about a gauge theory, and the gauge coupling is strong, and maybe I don't have recourse to use my Feynman diagrams or perturbation theory, I don't have a good weak coupling approximation that I can work in, something that I can always do, or in any quantum field theory when I have strong coupling, is to try to put it on the lattice and do things numerically, if you like. Or at least try to use a lattice approximation and then take the continuum limit afterward and see if I can still get reasonable answers that apply to my continuum theory. So I'd like to take that kind of lattice gauge theory approach in 2D angles. And the sort of beautiful and powerful thing that happens in two dimensions is that actually this process of cutting my space up into a mesh, into a discrete lattice, and taking the continuum limit is completely exact. In other words, 2D angles is an RG invariant notion. In general, I have to work really hard to take this continuum limit properly and make sense of my answers. In two dimensions, I can put my theory on a lattice, and I'll show that actually the lattice can be as coarse as I like, and actually still get exact answers even in the continuum theory. So that's the approach that I'll take to solve the theory. So, more precisely, what I'll try to show today is that at least the partition function is invariant under subdivisions of my mesh. So I should say a few words about how to think about gauge theory on the lattice instead of in the continuum. But the nice thing is that everything is as simple as possible. I have a discrete, my space-time has become discrete. And I can associate degrees of freedom to vertices and links rather than at every point in space. And this renders a lot of things particularly transparent. Okay, so the idea is to cover my surface sigma by polygons. And so the last gauge theory philosophy, or the sketch of it, is to now restrict my my G bundle P of n to live only on the vertices of the polygons. So restrict the bundle to the vertex set, which I'll call V. So V vertex set. So at every vertex, I have a copy of my bundle. And the gauge transformations now in this discrete space are just assigned at every point on my space, which are now just the vertices of this discrete set. So in other words, gauge transformations are maps from my vertex set to the gauge group, where to every x that's an element of my set, I assign some element of the gauge group at x. And the parallel, so the gauge connection, of course, normally it's a device, at least classically it's a device for parallel transporting things. If my space-time is discrete, I can only move from vertex 1 to vertex 2, or whatever vertex you like, along the prescribed edges of my graph. And so, rather than work with the gauge connection, it's much more natural to work directly with holonomy variables integrated from vertex A to vertex B. So, one of the nice things already is that in lattice gauge theory, you work directly with the holonomy variables, and in 2D angles, that's sort of the only interesting thing I have anyway. So things are going to start working out nicely. So here's a cartoon of one of my edges, one edge of my polygon, x, y, and let's call this edge gamma. And so for every edge, I have u sub gamma, which is an element of the gauge group. And that's another benefit of working with the holonomy variables. They're defined directly with respect to the gauge group. I don't have to talk about the Lie algebra, which is normally where the connection lives. It's a Lie algebra value one form. But here I have my elements of the group. And they transform, of course, under gauge transformations in the expected way, where I act on one side with g at point y, and on the other side with gx inverse. So this is the natural latticization of the gauge transformation. Sort of the only nice thing you can do. And whereas before on a continuum, I have my local factor, my nice continuum local factor with which I'll weight the path integral. Now what I need to do is some kind of latticization, discretization of this kind of thing. So I need to define a local version of my path integral weight sort of on every discrete chunk of my so in particular, let's subdivide my Riemann surface into plaquettes, named after Natalie Plaquette. Plaquettes that I'll label by, I'll call them W sub I, and I just extend over some finite range. And again, I'll soon prove that this chopping up into plaquettes can really be as coarse as I like, and I can still get exactly those, which is going to be the nice thing. So I need to define and justify, I need to at least propose and justify some discrete version of my actual one. And so let me write one down and then justify why it's sort of right. Solution of 2D mills, in particular using these lattice gauge theory methods, was first done by Mayhall. So let me write down the local functionals that Mayhall proposed. Okay. So what's the local contribution of a single plaquette? Well, let me write it down and then I'll define what I'm writing. So he said that the right thing to do is take a sum over all representations representations of G. Weighted by a character of some holonomy, which I'll explain in a moment, in the representation alpha, and then weight that sum by the following exponential factor. Okay, so what's going on? So I have some flathead. I'll just draw it like this. I'm on an oriented Riemann surface, so and the Wilson loops also have orientation, so I have some directed path, say, going like this around my flathead. And at each edge, I have some holonomy variable, U1, U2, and so on. So the only gauge invariant information that I could possibly write down about this thing is the product of all of these U's going around my flathead. So curly U is given by U1, and so on for the single flathead. So this curly U is the curly U that appears here. So taking the character of this curly U in the representation alpha, summing on alpha. And it's weighted by the quadratic Casimir of the representation alpha up to a constant factor, the constant factor up to this, up to also a factor of 2. This AW is the area of the flathead. So why is this the right thing? Well, first of all, one thing to notice, first, just consider taking the area of the flathead to zero size. Well, what I get is just a sum on alpha of chi alpha of u times the dimension of alpha. And it's a basic result in group theory that exactly that sum is equal to the delta function of u minus 1. So if the area goes to zero, then sum of dim alpha chi alpha u is just this delta function defined on the group. So the holonomy is base to 1. And that makes sense because if I'm imagining my theory discretized and I want to take some kind of continuum limit, well, this Wilson loop is shrinking to zero size in the continuum, which I expect that I shouldn't get any interesting contribution about. And that is motivating this this constant multiple factor here. So that looks pretty reasonable so far.
Sorry, can you just remind me what kind of object this is? This is supposed to be...
This will be, so this gamma is going to be my local contribution to the action.
So gamma is like Li?
Gamma is going to be e to the minus.
E to the minus. Right.
So eventually, what I'm going to do is just essentially plug a bunch of these gammas together for each plug that I have. But first, I need to just justify that this is kind of the right thing for a single plug. Okay, so that was a fine plausibility check, and it helps us essentially fix this coefficient. And of course, any observable has to be decomposed as some kind of linear combination of, in this case, class functions.
This gamma is a function of all the UIs, is that right?
A function of, oh, yeah, exactly. So this curly U that appears here is a product of the holonomy, of the holonomies around each edge. So I'm imagining just a close. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because the only gauge invariant information I can have about this bucket is the holonomy around the closed loop that's defined by going around all the edges and going back to yourself. Yeah, so gamma is a function of that holonomy u around the given flathead, and it's also a function of the area subtended by. Okay. So the area goes to zero check is nice, but more importantly than that, is that you can actually show that these local factors give you a theory that's invariant under refinements or subdivisions of any given flathead, which is kind of the crucial insight to make and why all of the computations that I can do in 2D Yang-Mills theory are really the exact answers, even in the continuum limit. Okay? So, and Also, quite crucially, you see that when I start multiplying these gamma factors together, say the contribution from two flat hats, one with area one and one with area two, then because of the exponential, the areas will sum, which already is very natural if my theory only depends not on the metric, but on this area form or the measure. So area should add, that's really nice. And the quadratic Casimir you might also anticipate to be the correct thing, just because that was the form that my Hamiltonian takes when acting on this. So you could also consider some other theory with a different action, and you might not get the quadratic Casimir, but everything else had better be the same if you want these consistency conditions to kind of apply. You still want the areas to add. Okay, good. So let me write down what a full partition function would look like, and then I'll prove that it's invariant under subdivision of the black hats into smaller pieces. So the full lattice path integral of my surface with some polygonization that I'll call x ultimately will be a function of the total area of the surface, and I should obtain it by, well, instead of integrating over all gauge connections and dealing with issues of the measure and a continuum field theory, I just have to instead take the measure that comes from producting all of the different u's on all of the edges of my surface. That's the analog here. And again, I'm working in the Haar measure where the volume of the group is normalized to 1, so that's kind of straightforward. And then I just product over all of the flat hats, which were indexed by I, my wi's, of these local density factors. Curly I associated to one flat hat and the area is dependent. So again, I index all the flat hats in my subdivision x, and gamma index all the edges. So this is what the partition function should look like. And what I'd like to argue is that z sigma x as a function of area is the same as z sigma of x prime, some other subdivision, some other choice of triangulation. Even though when I say triangulation, I really mean any polygon that I wish. I can discretize each any polygon. Okay, so to do this, let me just be a little bit more simple in the interest of time, and just argue that if I take one flat hat in the form of a square and cut it in half, that I get the same answer. It's very easy to generalize this argument to the most general situation. So here I have my square with holonomy variables u1, u2, u3, and u4. And I'd like to now just add an extra edge to cut it into two further pieces. And I'll call this variable v. And if the total area of my square is a0, and this triangle, let's say, has area a prime and area double prime down here, then a0, of course, has to be a prime plus a double prime. Okay. So the local factor corresponding to my square is exactly the kind of thing I wrote before. So this is first the square without the extra internal edge. The local factor is just the dimension times the character of u1, u2, u3, u4, times that exponential factor of just minus a0 and c2 alpha. Okay. But what about the contribution from the two triangles? So, well, the Wilson loops are oriented, so depending if I'm talking about, if I'm going around this triangle this way, then I've denoted by a V by the edge going to the left. Whereas if I go around this way, I should have, instead, a factor of V inverse because I've reversed the orientation, and orientation reversal will invert the corresponding matrix. So for the two triangles, I can just write, again, the obvious thing. So now I have a double sum over two variables, alpha and beta, where alpha is is associated to the bottom triangle with holonomy U1, U2V, chi beta, V inverse, Q3, E4, and the obvious exponential factor. Just be a little fast. And so all I need to do to prove the invariance under subdivision, at least in the square example, is to show that if I integrate out the V first, and I can choose to integrate the holonomy variables in any order that I choose, that I'll recover the local factor associated to gamma. So in other words, integral over V of gamma, oops, sorry, gamma prime, gamma double prime, should be gamma itself. Okay. And that's immediately true from a basic group theoretic identity on the characters. So let me just write it down. And it's not hard to prove by yourself. But here's just a basic identity of characters. And it follows essentially just from orthogonality relations of the characters and the realization of these characters as functions on the group manifold. So this is a basic identity, and if I apply it, I immediately get the desired equivalence. Therefore, the partition function of the theory doesn't care about how I'm splitting up the discretization. And the great thing about that is that once I have invariance under subdivision, well, on the one hand, you could make the lattice really, really fine and feel very happy that you're looking at something that looks very close to a continuum of field theory. Or more pragmatically, you could say, I'm a person and I want to do the easiest computations possible, so I'm going to discretize my surface sigma by the simplest possible polygon I have and do the computations on the coarsest possible discretization of the lattice. And in practice, that's what you'd like to do. And using the most discrete, using the most discrete possible discretization of the lattice, I'll write down the partition function for any closed-oriented genus G surface present.
So I thought orthogonality of the characters held for your equal representations. Are we just summing over those for all forms?
I think that game should just be your X.
So that one should just be X.
Oh, I'm sorry. Any other questions? Okay, great. So any orientable surface of genus G actually emits a super easy discretization into polygons. In fact, the most famous one, or the famous one, I should say, is that, well, any genus G surface that's closed and oriented can be expressed as a 4G-sided polygon with the edges suitably identified. And this follows from the fact that the fundamental group of the genus G surface has 2G generators with one relation. You guys, I'm sure, all know. A1 inverse, B1 inverse, and so on. So, presentation of the fundamental group, that's where this kind of polygonization comes from. And so I can immediately kind of write down the answer just using the simple coarsest possible resolution of my space. So here I have the same sort of weighting factors that I saw before. But what do they call my generators? Ui and Vi. So there's G of each of them. And I can do, so the only non-trivial thing other than the sum is to do this integral, to do these integrals over the various holonomy variables. And again, since I have these characters of my group G, I can solve these integrals essentially iteratively using basic relations that arise from group theory. In particular, I can use this one, and I can also use let me write it up here, identity double star as du pi alpha a u b u inverse, which you can show, again, is 1 over the dimension of alpha, pi alpha a, pi alpha b. So if I apply the identity star and double star, you guys can show in a few lines that what I expect to get at the end of the day for a closed genus G Riemann surface is that the partition function is just e to the minus the total area, c2 alpha over 2, divided by a weighting factor that's the dimension of the representation to 2g minus 2. Essentially, because all these identities will bring down various factors of the dimension, it'll bring down 2g of these factors, but at the end of the day, I'm left with some characters of the identity, chi alphas of the identity, which removes a couple factors from the top, and so I just end up with a factor that depends on the Euler characteristic of the surface. So it's kind of easy to crank through this manipulation and just get the answer. Hopefully it's clear, even if I skip some steps, hopefully it's clear how you would approach these kinds of integrals and get the answer. Okay. Something very similar also holds true for a surface with boundaries, where I have some unglued boundaries and I have some specified holonomy along the various boundary circles. So essentially, you get the same kind of expressions to the partition function for an oriented surface with boundary. If I just additionally have some factors that depend on the holonomy values of boundary. So let me just write it down. So if I have a surface instead of B boundaries, I can use exactly the same kinds of chains of reasoning, where the partition function will now depend not only on the area A, but also on whatever Wilson loop or whatever holonomy I specify on the boundary circles, there should be B of them, and I get the same kind of sum, same exponential factor, but now the dimension, of course, will be 2g plus b minus 2, I've got the sign right, plus the product from 1 to b over the chi alphas of b squares. Okay. Any questions about that kind of logic? Or good. Is this legible? Here, it's, everything is the same except instead of 2g minus 2, it's 2g plus b minus 2, and I have a product over the characters of the associated boundary Wilson space.
Are the formulas for like point functions and correlations as well?
Yep, and hopefully I will get to them in a few minutes after I just make some remarks. But as you might expect, I can essentially follow the same kind of logic to get correlation functions of Wilson lines if I just cut the surface, triangulate the boundary circle in a compatible way with the rest of the discretization, and do the same kinds of manipulations. And this works for non-intersecting Wilson loops and intersecting Wilson loops, and I hopefully will just have a quick remark about how the answers differ in those two cases, because you get some interesting looking representation theoretic things. Any other questions before I... let's see. Okay, so before I say something about Wilson loops, I want to make a couple remarks, which will be deliberately a bit vague, but you can ask me more after, and I can also point to references that make everything I say much, much more precise. So first of all, because 2D Angles doesn't depend on the metric, it only depends on the area of my surface, it's very, very close to a topological quantum field theory, and you might hope that since I'm in low dimensions and have a huge amount of symmetry, that the theory should admit some axiomatization along the lines of Atiyah's TQFT axioms or Siegel's CFT axioms, and indeed there is an axiomatization that works for 2D TQFT. I think Lorenz Siegel is the relevant reference for 2D Yang-Mills. But indeed you expect that, you know, the associated geometric category here, I think, is pretty apparent from the considerations. The object should be oriented circles, the morphism should be oriented surfaces coordinate between the circles, and the field theory is associated to the geometric data. Everything goes through totally functorially. I glue surfaces together, areas add exactly by construction. And so if I wanted to start with some basic building blocks, I could write down the amplitude just for a cylinder, which is a special case of that this expression here with two boundaries. And I could write down also an amplitude for the disk, which since it depends on the area, I can just get from essentially the amplitude of a single black hat of the same corresponding area. And then from the cap or the disc and the cylinder, I can glue up everything I wish. And it all goes through. So that's very nice. Let's see. I think that's all I wanted to think about that point. Okay. And
do you ever see dependence on the bundles? You might think if you have a U1 gauge field, you would want to sum up of return classes.
Yeah, so this is kind of embedded in the localization story that I did not explain clearly earlier, but I can rewrite this partition function as a sum over non-trivial bundles following a TIA watch.
So it's automatic.
There's a dualization between homonymy variables and instanton variables, it turns out.
Right.
It's basically like baby S duality in this case. And if I had spent more time and talked about the classical solutions and the gauge connections, it's kind of easy to see all the bundles you need and how they sum up in this way. But yeah, 2D Engels has a dual description. The holonomy is simpler, but there's a nice instanton picture in terms of summing the variables on the surface. Which you might also expect because I've discretized the surface, so I've lost information about interesting bundle topology. So sort of implicitly, there's a sum in this very coarse lattice description that I had better recover because it coincides with the continuum. And I will write down the Wilson loop correlation function, but I also just wanted to make a remark that's a little bit relevant to more the spirit of these lectures. So first of all, there's a way to rewrite 2D Engels, which is perhaps a little bit nicer for some purposes, especially for BVifying everything I've said, called the first order formalism, where for my purposes today, I'll just view it as a rewriting of the action. I guess I should call this B. I have phi in my notes, but anyway. So I rewrite the action, not only in terms of my two-form f, but also in terms of an adjoint-valued scalar called b. You can easily check that this is equivalent to the original action. Everything's quadratic. I can integrate out b by replacing b with the solution to its equation of motion. I recover the original Yang-Mills action. But the way things are written, it also makes a few features a little bit more transparent. In particular, remember I told you that the area and the gauge coupling come as a pair. So here, only in the second term do I have the gauge coupling. It's paired with the area. So I can imagine, just looking at this expression, taking the limit as the area goes to zero and recovering this TQFT called BF theory, which is nice for many purposes. And BF path integrals are closely related to things like Reissinger torsion. You can compute determinants of path integrals very explicitly. And Schwartz, I think, has maybe done the earliest work on this. But someone should correct me if I have my references wrong. And in this BF theory, you can also prove a lot of nice geometric things, like the path integral computes the volume of the moduli space of flat connections, mod G. Which I haven't explained, but with respect to a natural symplectic form that comes from pairing delta A, where A is the connection. So this story might be very familiar to many of you. So the partition function of BF theory computes symplectic volumes. It's also closely related to Chern-Simons theory, which I think Dupay will talk about later this week or next week, and connections, therefore, also to rational conformal field theories also come into play in these kinds of stories. Anything else I want to say at the moment? And given this rewriting in terms of BF theory, it's also very natural to write the BV version of this action. I think Chris will do the analogous thing in four dimensions tomorrow. So that's very nice, and you can immediately go between the pictures that you were learning in the lecture already. You can also say more refined things about Yang-Mills' topological field theory, so I haven't said anything. So I've said something about two-Yang-Mills theory and the relation to cohortisms of oriented surfaces. You can also talk about 2D Yang-Mills theory on things like intervals, and I think maybe Tudor or Davide will later explain something about the relationship between Kazuel duality of algebras and boundary conditions in physical gauge theories. And in 2D Yang-Mills, you can sort of immediately talk about these kinds of nice algebraic refinements that are a little bit more modern than the things that I've told you about so far by considering, you know, Yang-Mills theory on a space with a boundary interval rather than a boundary circle, or think more generally about something like a stratified circle. And essentially, I view Yang-Mills as producing for you certain DG bimodules where, depending on your choice of boundary conditions, you'll either get something like exterior powers of the Dooley algebra, or the Shevely-Eilenberg differential, or you might get a sin of G, a trivial differential, roughly speaking, up to things I'm suppressing, and kind of see a baby example of Kazuel duality here, which would be related to things that you'll learn in more generality, probably later when we talk more about boundary conditions and these kinds of things. So you can view stratified circles as tensor products of these DG bimodules, get more refined information about 2D angles. Oh, and I should also say that there's a reference here if you care to learn more about BV, BFV versions of 2D Yang-Mills, just from last year by Nev and Erasso. It's 1 year. Okay, so I'm running out of time, so I want to briefly write down the answer, I think, for at least the non-intersecting Wilson lines, maybe make a couple more general remarks about connections to other things, and then I'll stop. So any more questions before I do that? Non-intersecting case, work using just the same logic that I used to compute the partition function, where we, you know, slice up the surface along some oriented circle C, which I view as the support of my Wilson lines, and then I integrate the pieces together against the holonomy variable associated to that line. And since I'm running out of time, I can essentially write down the answer, but you'll see that, again, it follows from exactly the same kinds of cutting and gluing considerations that work just as well for the partition function. So for non-intersecting Wilson lines, for notation, let me say that I split my surface up along some closed curves gamma. So sigma minus gamma splits up into some disjoint connected components that I'll call sigma sub C. C will be the support of the Wilson lines that will show up. So I should have some product over all of the gammas of Wilson lines, which depend on the representation for each gamma and the location of the curves themselves. And it's the same thing, I just have a few more products. So I product along a product index by all of the gammas, and a product along the connected components. Let me just write everything out. So here I have my insertions of the Wilson lines. I'm breaking things up into components. This expression will simplify momentarily. Let me just put a little bit more notation on the board. Okay. So I have this expression. Again, C labels the connected components. Each of them has their own associated area, A sub C. And because I'm cutting them, they'll have boundary components where I again have to keep track of the orientation of the boundaries as I glue them together. And the boundary components have associated holonomy variables that I'm identifying with the Wilson loop holonomy variable, and then I'm integrating over it. And I can make this cutting and gluing choice consistently because my surface is oriented and the Wilson line is oriented. So here I can sort of wiggle the Wilson line a little bit and associate a left component and a right component, or left and right boundaries of the associated pieces, and glue them together. So sorry that was a little fast, but hopefully the idea is fairly intuitive. But in particular, I just want to point out that when I have an expression like this and I want to manipulate the correlation function into a more manageable form, what I'll end up having is a number of integrals like this related to the boundary components of my cutting and gluing surfaces and the support of the Wilson line. So I'll have an integral with sort of three characters in play. And then I know something group theoretically here. So here I'll have many terms of the form R1, R2, and R3 associated to the cutting and gluing. But I know something about what the multiplicities or what these integrals should produce based on knowing about the multiplicities with which representations, say, R1 and R2 decompose into representation R3. These are, I know how to compute Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. So R1 times R2 and R3, R1, R2, R3. So I group theorize the decomposition, and I can evaluate these integrals using this data. And then at the end, what I'll have is a sum over irreps associated to my components, product over components, the dimension of the representation, again, the Euler characters, again, of now my component Riemann surfaces, the same exponential factor, which I won't write down. It's the same one as before. And then gamma over my coefficients. So I'm moving a little fast here just to kind of get to some punchlines. But here the components are again the support of the Wilson line and then the surface that I get by moving a little bit to the left and a little bit to the right. Again, I can consistently identify these things because everything in sight is oriented. So again, just to stress, for any product of non-intersecting Wilson loops, I get some expression like this that only depends on some simple group theory data. And I can compute everything with these basic integral identities that I told you before. You can also exactly compute correlation functions for intersecting Wilson lines. I won't go through details, but I'm dealing with situations like this, where I have two Wilson lines crossing and some black heads. So just to motivate what's happening, each of my Wilson lines are labeled by some representation. I also have the plaquettes, and their holonomy variables will be in some representations. And I'm just drawing this picture because you notice that in particular there's six different representations that are coming into play here. And so the analogous expressions that I'll get for the correlation of functions of Wilson line won't be based on I won't have factors of Clebsch-Gordan coefficients here, but rather I'll have factors related to 6J symbols instead, coming from getting these kind of factors right. And 6J symbols are also deeply associated to integrable models. In particular, in this case, 2D Yang-Mills is related to some integrable models in statistical mechanics. And so you can get some, you're starting to see hints of integrability coming by looking at correlation functions of these intersecting Wilson lines. McDowell and Makayenko showed that Wilson loop correlators actually satisfy a sequence of nice differential equations, loop equations. That sort of is another way to view the solubility of the theory or the hidden integrability here. And I sort of view this interesting hint of integrability intersecting Wilson lines as maybe a proto version of a very interesting program that Kevin and also Yamazaki and Witten have been playing with in a higher dimensional twisted 4D theory. So again, intersecting Wilson lines can lead to interesting things about integrable lattice models. So if you're familiar with that work or interested in it, there's sort of some simpler flavor of that kind of thing going on here. But at minimum, the model is solvable. I can write down these quantities exactly. No problem. Just in terms of this group theoretic data. Okay, so I'm out of time, and I don't think I had any more really important remarks to make, but just one more cute thing that I'll end with that I haven't had time to talk about at all, is that even though I wasn't doing any Feynman diagrams here, there are still interesting perturbative limits that I can take in gauge theory related to this coupling I wrote, related to considering instead of just the gauge coupling, I can consider thinking about reorganizing the theory in terms of the rank of the gauge group and this factor lambda that I called the Etup coupling earlier. And I can take, in particular, the limit of the gauge theory as n gets very, very large and do kind of perturbative calculations in 1 over n. That's an interesting thing to do for various reasons, and it's an interesting thing to do at higher dimensions as well. And it turns out that even 2D angles in this large n limit is deeply related to things like Hurwitz numbers that count branch coverings of Riemann surfaces. And that looks already like kind of something you might expect a baby string theory to do. It's kind of like a baby Gromov with counting problem. And so you might think that 2D angles theory at large n is related at least to some kind of topological string theory because it seems to be doing some non-trivial enumerative geometry. And that turns out to be true, though obviously I won't explain it. But there's all kinds of also nice reformulations of this large N angles theory that leads to some interesting and deep stuff. Okay, that's it.
Are there any similar games you can play if there's matter in the field theory as well? Or is this pretty much strictly pure Yang Mills?
Well, once I add matter, I lose my nice lambda metric dependence. There's an obvious deformation, so this doesn't answer your question, but I can deform Yang Mills by instead of thinking of my simple quadratic action, I can instead think of an action involving gauge invariant polynomials in my variable g. That's an interesting deformation of Yang Mills that's still area preserving. Once I add matter, maybe there's just some games you can play, but it kind of looks like it naively spoils the solubility. But it's definitely interesting
to do. So the connection with the topological string?
Yeah.
Here, we don't have a suitable supersymmetry, so how would it be? How would it be?
It arises from so 2D angles can be realized as a localized subsector of a certain eight model topological string on a non-compact Calabi-Yau, where my surface sigma is sort of the base of my Calabi-Yau, and I have two non-compact fibers given by certain mind bundles with appropriate Chern classes. And if I do an equivariant localization along the rotation of those non-compact fibers and I localize my eight model string to the surface, it turns out that I actually reproduce ordinary A model, and so the Gromov-Witten theory sort of localized to that base, the compact base, gives me a better one.
Thank you. Are there any interesting subtleties that arise when you consider other groups, like other series of groups?
There are certainly subtleties.
Yes.
You can still compute everything and write down the answers.
So the theory
it's
is
in the review and for orthogonal and symplectic groups and all of that.
What about exceptional groups? Also, or? But for all classical groups, or
yeah.
Compact classical groups. Okay.
The second Casimir played a role in all these formulas here for the partition function.
Yeah.
Do higher Casimirs play any role in the Yang-Mills theory?
You could change the form of that function, again, if I started adding polynomial, or maybe even non-polynomial functions of B. So polynomial functions of B should certainly give me something. I'm not sure off the top of my head because I haven't tried it.
But I imagine if you considered interesting like non-polynomial deformations as a function of B, I imagine you could get like some cuneiform Yang nulls. Again, probably. I'm kind of making stuff up. That's very good. But I think that actually might work. Any other questions?
Is there a nice like I'm sorry if you said this already. Is there a nice Hamiltonian type formulation where you like say you do the version with boundary and you say what happens on a pair of pants? And is there do you get
yeah,
like, a nice formula?
And the pair of pants, you know, I'll have the same kinds of things I wrote before. Like this, you know, for the cylinder I have two boundaries, same kind of stuff I wrote before. For the pair of pants I have three two bras and a cat. Where I associate a representation to each hole in the Hamiltonian formulation. And because of orthogonality relations in the group, all these R's are the same for the pair of pants.
In other words, the only non-zero terms in the map.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's where all the R, and the same for the cylinder. Maybe this. But it's basically immediate from what I wrote down. Instead of the boundary holonomies, but the states. And this we know what the states are spanned by. They're spanned by the era.
Let's take that one.